Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
But you would have a perverse scenario where the torturer and the tortured would discuss the goals between both absolutely hideous, but also speaks of the extraordinary thing that is football.
Welcome all, it is episode 67 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is the Argentine football writer and broadcaster Marcela Mora y Araujo. Marcela has written for a number of publications, including The Guardian and The Financial Times. She also co-authored Ozzy Ardiles' autobiography and translated Diego Maradona's into English. And Marcela has also interviewed the biggest names in Argentine football, including Maradona, Alfredo Di Stefano, and of course, Lionel Messi. Before we get to our chat with Marcela, a heads up that we're doing a live podcast hangout with Roy Thompson next week, and it is exclusive to you 42 members. It is on Tuesday, 16th of March at 8 o'clock, so it's the night before St. Patrick's Day. So please do log on and join us. We will chat a bit with Wright about his own stories and about some of the people and some of the elite sports stars that he has profiled. Woods and Messi and Michael Jordan come to mind. But we want the chat to be steered by you, mainly because it's the night before St. Patrick's Day. I'll be off the next day and I fully intend to have a drink. So do log on, pour yourself a drink and join us for that conversation. You will have been emailed the details by now, but if you haven't got them or if you do have any other questions for us, get in touch behindthelines@the42.ie, or if you're in the WhatsApp group, you'll have my number there, so you can ping me. So that's all next week, but now let's get on with our conversation on this episode of Behind the Lines with Marcela Mora y Araujo. Marcela, thanks so much for doing the show. How are you?
Hello, how are you? It's an honour to be asked.
That's very kind of you. So you're in Buenos Aires at the moment, is that right?
Yes, kind of accidentally, but yes, I am here now for the foreseeable.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the lockdown situation like in Buenos Aires?
Or is there one?
Well, we have no lockdown at the moment to speak of. There are protocols. So, you know, masks everywhere and alleged limits of people in inside restaurants and bars. Today's the first day of the main theatre is opening, the Colón Theatre, for it's a classical music venue, and they're doing the first concert today, and I've literally just been offered a ticket. So there's an incredible protocol to get in, like, you know, ID number and emergency contact number and so on. So I'll see how that goes. I'm a little bit nervous because I haven't really been inside spaces for that long, since March last year, but it's, I think, 30% capacity and blah blah blah, so they're trying to open stuff up. Schools open this week, so again, most kids never went to school last year, so we have to see what happens.
The most important thing, obviously, is the football. Like, are the games being played behind closed doors? And if so, I would imagine that's a hugely diminished event, particularly in Argentina.
I think it's the most salient thing about the football, that there's no crowds. But in Argentina, since 2013, away fans have been banned. Anyway, so I guess it's just kind of leveled up. So now, you know, you used to be just home fans and now there's no fans. But it is quite odd. And there's a massive scrap going on with European clubs because they won't release internationals for the World Cup qualifiers. So there's a big meeting yesterday and another today. The South American variant is allegedly worse. And I don't know. I just saw yesterday that Infantino suggesting South American qualifiers are played in Europe, which I think is just nonsense, really. But yeah. I'm sure it'll happen.
Yeah, we'll come back to that in a little while, because I think that's quite an interesting thing in the sense of the migration of the sport to Europe. I think that's the next front, the next step in that. But we will ask you about yourself for a few moments, if you're not too bashful. Did you always want to write about football, or was this a kind of a happy accident?
I think Well, I always wrote. I don't know if I always wanted to write, but I always did. And no, I didn't particularly want to write about football in a conscious way. But when I started working in the media in England, it was quite obvious that I was going to be limited to writing about South America or Argentina. That was quite clear from very early. So I did some stuff about hyperinflation and some stuff about the disappeared and some stuff about the Falklands. I actually started working in a TV production company, but it was inside the Observer building. It was part of the Observer group. And I used to go around the paper trying to get bits of writing into various sections. It was quite hard to break into. I mean, I remember the fashion editor just staring at me and saying, "You can't just come and write about fashion. Have to be super cool and have some kind of," and then I used to do tiny book reviews, paperbacks, three in a batch, and they were very small, and like you didn't get a byline, you just had to be very grateful that they published them at all. But one day I was walking across the massive open plan building in Battersea. It's long since moved, and as I walked past the sports desk, they had a big TV screen, and there was an Argentinian scored a try in Cardiff. It was quite a momentous occasion. And I looked up and I said, "Oh my God, I went to school with him." And the whole desk just turned around and said to me, "Can you talk to him?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course." And there was just a serendipity about that, the combination of first the access that I had, which had never occurred to me to tap into sport, but also the kind of welcoming and genuine admiration and delight from my peers, which was so different to every other desk or every other section or whatever you want to call them. So I rang my mate Herman, and our PE teacher from school was training the Puma. So I started doing quite a lot of things with rugby, actually, and at that time. And, well, in fact, to this day, that player has power of attorney over my Argentinian. But, you know, we're really good friends. And I think, I mean, over time, I've often been asked, how did I get into sport and why? And I think, ultimately, it was something about being Argentinian and that not being a terrible downer. You know, it was a kind of, you were on an equal footing. Moving on to football, there was an incredible fascination and respect, and it wasn't that easy to gather information in those days. It was pre-internet, so all of that was very good. And then I moved from TV to radio, and I worked at the World Service, and when I asked to cover sports, I was literally told, "No, you can't do that because you're a woman." So that was really okay. You know, now I'm going to have to do this, and it's going to be quite hard. But clearly, I can't just not do it because I'm a woman. But, you know, there was a combination of all those things, and I think the level of the richness of the good story was just amazing. And yes, I mean, well, one could go delve even further, but who cares? You know, psychoanalytically, you could say, you know, maybe I just wanted my dad to like me or something. But ultimately, I think that's how it happened. And also, I think there wasn't that much of a kind of outside the sports pages. There wasn't that much acknowledgement or recognition as this being a rich field of intellectual inquiry. That doesn't sound too pretentious. And there was, you know, there's always been amazing sports writing and profound and moving stuff. But I think I just got in there at a time when it was beginning to open up, around the time that Fever Pitch was published, around the time that, you know, Sky in England did their massive deal with football rights, and football moved away from Sunday to cover other days. In Argentina, it was around that time also big rights happened. There was a wealth of sports programming that needed to be filled by new cable companies and so on. So both in terms of me personally and what I wanted to do in the media and the climate in the industry, the early 90s was a kind of it was around about the time that 442 was created and devised as a thoughtful magazine. Also, actually, the idea of a group of women of a woman. So I think it was just a very nice moment to kind of enter the arena. And then, of course, Maradona existed. So
yeah,
like, that's the muse to beat all muses. That was, you know.
Okay, so this is the early 90s you're talking about. So this is post 1986 and the World Cup quarterfinal. Now, the English tabloid press are still obsessed with that game and I'm still obsessed about Maradona and are quite anti-Argentinian, if I can use that phrase. And you could see that even on Diego's death a few months ago. So to what extent was that reflected your way? Did you get a tough time as an Argentinian woman in working in the English football press?
No, I didn't at all on those grounds. I mean, I was an Argentinian schoolgirl in school in England during the Falklands War. So, I didn't get a tough time. I think people are mostly very decent all over the world, and what the tabloids do to is kind of not. I don't know, it's a thing that doesn't really have anything to do with the way people behave. I wasn't in England during the 1986 World Cup, so I didn't get the relish of that. I do find it quite exhausting to have to discuss the one goal versus the other and so on. But what I found with Maradona over time is that football fans worldwide really, really are smitten by him, even if they want to say, oh, fat cheat or whatever, they still want to talk about him. And, you know, it's a kind of compulsion to know more about him, discuss him, express your opinion. I think that some people have that effect where they just make everyone want to tell you what they think about that. Very, very specific. As if it's a special and unique thing. And I didn't really delve into Maradona as such until 1994, which was the World Cup when he got kicked out in the USA, when he got walked off the pitch by a nurse. And by then I was already working in the media. And then I did mind British media coverage because I felt it was inadequate and not nuanced enough. And I was reading the news that day myself at the World Service, and I was refusing to read the news as if maybe that if I didn't say it, it wouldn't have happened. But at that point, I did begin to think this is quite an interesting thing, this Maradona fella. And then very quickly got a chance to meet him and sort of hang out, and that really sent me off in a different direction, because I think apart from anything else, hanging out with him and his entourage allowed my writing to kind of be a little bit of a, you know, an old-fashioned long read chronicle style, which I really like, actually. And if I could choose every day, I would choose that kind of go somewhere, get in there, and then just describe it.
Talk to us about your memories of hanging out with Diego and his entourage. And is this in the mid-1990s, and where in,
yeah,
where in the world,
no,
is
well,
this?
Yeah, exactly, 95 I met him. I met him in 94 doing something else, and he was managing here in Argentina. And I'd also in late 94, maybe January 95, in mid-94, after the World Cup, I did I had to do a project for the World Service, a kind of a package, and I'd started doing something about how woeful the coverage of South America was in the British press generally, kind of tagged on to the quote of this massive investigative research reporter at the BBC who'd said, as for South America, it might as well not exist for the coverage we get in the UK. And then halfway through, I just kind of thought, oh, no, I'm going to do this about Maradona getting kicked out of the World Cup, and found, you know, sounds of the stadium, his own voice, and did this kind of, and it was picked by the person organizing the thing as the best. And it, you know, it was just, it's like if you go Maradona, you're like immediately on a different level to everything else that's going on. I found people that were critical of him and so on. So it wasn't a Maradona praise piece, but just the atmosphere that you can garner in radio anyway, which is a medium I love. And it was exciting. People sit up and go, oh, what was that?
Yeah.
A little bit like when I walk past, you know, the try in Cardiff, and everyone went, oh, sport does that. And I suppose other things also do that, but sport definitely does it. It's like it just goes straight to the emotional and the adrenaline.
That's classic Maradona, though, isn't it, Marcella? That I meant to be doing this project and radio documentary on a country, if not an entire continent, but actually Diego Maradona is the story here, as if he's bigger than the nation itself.
Yes.
Like, I don't think, when I was reading, you did a fantastic piece for The Guardian just shortly after his death, and I read so many pieces, and the main thing I took from them was that I don't think there's ever been a footballer or possibly an athlete so easily identifiable with a national character. Is that fair?
Well, I try to pinpoint exactly what it is that makes him so Argentinian, or Argentinians so fond of him. But then increasingly I see that people around the world feel like that about him. So I think he's at once the symbol of Argentinianness and completely universal. And I think that's part of the difficult to pinpoint thing about. So I've seen people, I live in London usually, and I live in a flat, and above my flat there is another flat. And during the 2010 World Cup, there was a massive, but really big, like stadium-sized banner from the flat above me that with an Argentinian flag that said Diego. And people would come from the end of the road, you can see kind of my doorway, and they would say, oh, I passed by your house the other day, or just literally friends go, how did you get that banner out there? And I was like, I it's got nothing to do with me. It's my Bangladeshi neighbor. I was like, what? And he said, oh, we love Maradona, you know, yes, we love Maradona. So that's, I think, to me, that's, well, I love that whole setup, because it's really only in central London could all of that happen. But I really think he's very universal, and at the same time he's incredibly Argentinian. Like he can really be from somewhere else in a way. But I suppose, well, I tried to kind of get to that in the Guardian piece by saying I don't know why coming from the same country as someone makes you feel particularly special about that person. I mean, I suppose one could say it about Joyce, or but Argentinians definitely have maybe it's got to do with being a newish society, newish country, you know, the ancient history here is 200 years old. Somehow the immigrant population is literally 98%, whether it's 200 years or 50 years or now, but it's a very welcoming, opening society through sheer necessity. Like, how else can you build a country? And for some reason, although lots of people still speak their own language, their food rituals, religiousness is varied, the search for some sort of cohesion or national unity or national identity has come through football. I don't know why here more so than in other countries, but it clearly has. So football has given a sense of what it means, and the Maradona on top of that has totally elevated it. But we're very proud of Di Stefano having been Argentinian, and Di Stefano actually managed three countries, played in Colombia, ended up in Spain. And I interviewed him a few years ago, and I said, do you feel Spanish or Argentinian? Because I saw in various interviews he would claim huge pride for being Argentinian or Spanish, depending on. And he said, one is a little bit from where one is born and a lot from where one is fed. And I was born in Argentina, but Spain gave me a living. And I thought that was a lovely kind of, you know, modern concept of nationality, and it just speaks about to so much of exile and migration, and, you know, we all move around.
Mm. So to what extent has Di Stefano captured hearts and minds in Argentina then, if you were to compare him to Maradona?
Hugely. You can't compare him to Maradona because he didn't win a World Cup, and because he's from a time that there was less archive TV and so on. So it's only in a generation that's now waning that Di Stefano was as enormous. But he really, really, I mean, not just Di Stefano, that entire River Plate, Magic players of a certain time, they are incredibly entrenched in the hearts of football fans. And the entire narrative of our history, we are so good, we are the best. And I mean, I think there was a history of soccer that Guy Oliver wrote maybe about 20 or 30 years ago, which is a world compendium. And he wrote, nobody is playing the game longer than the British, or as well, and nobody has played it better than the Argentinians. And I think that's possibly still true. You know, there's people here say, oh, well, it's a British game. If the British might have invented it and be the mother of football, but we're the father, in a kind of ha, ha, ha. It's a really, I think the Argentinian influence has actually had world impact as well. So lots of things like yellow and red cards come about because of an Argentinian player's actions, and just the combination of the styles. In a way, it's very yin and yang, and you could say the Argentinians are loose with the rules and the English are incredibly rigid with them, but really it's more dynamic and it flows more. But so the whole early years of last century in Argentina are very much in the romantic notion of football lovers.
Mm.
You know, people know about the railways, about the first clubs and alumni and this and that. And then the mid-century, when it just became wow, and at club level it was really organized and professional, and there were these fantastic players like you know, Di Stefano, but Moreno and Pedernera, and people know this. I mean, I don't know if kids know it, but the club lover, River Plate fans would know it. Their father would talk about it. Their grandfather would talk about it. So Di Stefano is very, very, very revered and admired and acknowledged. Maybe respected more, if you like. Maradona is not universally loved by any means. He's just the biggest thing that belongs to us. But, you know, with license to criticize and so on. A lot of people don't like him at all.
Yeah, just to, on Di Stefano, and this is my ignorance showing now, but I'm actually surprised that he is as revered as he is based on that comment about how he feels more Spanish than Argentinian, because my experience of that is Lionel Messi. And from what I gather, and you can tell me I'm wrong, Messi has never really had that level of love in Argentina. I've always compared him to Maradona, but Di Stefano is actually arguably a more interesting comparison.
Well, I think you can, I mean, there's, first of all, I don't know that everybody in the country absolutely adores Di Stefano. In response to your question, is he a lot less revered than Maradona? I would say it's a time factor rather than a lesser personality, although not winning a World Cup is a factor. Messi has also not won a World Cup. So winning a World Cup is a really big thing to entrench you in the kind of, you know, respectability or adoration or whatever you want to call it. Di Stefano left Argentina during a player's strike and then kind of came back as manager and did very well and then moved to Spain. So he was by then married, an adult, had, you know, seeking work conditions, making his own decisions, negotiating his way. And so what I think what he said about being a little bit from where one is born and a lot from where one is fed is has to do with work and finding opportunities and being able to succeed and make a living in your chosen field, which is a huge privilege and a luxury for most people in the world, and certainly for most people born in the humble backgrounds that he was. And I think that's a very respectful thing to say, which is not to say that he didn't remember every street and every biscuit and every bit of ground where he played Kipiapi as a child in La Boca. That was totally part of who he was as well. Messi's a completely different case because Messi didn't make any choice himself. He was taken as a child for health reasons, in fact. So it's a different type of migration, if you like. His father had a work and a house, and so they weren't as poor as most of the, as a lot of the football players started out as being. And he, essentially, he grew up in Barcelona, and he could have played for Spain. You know, it was a very near miss. I mean, there was a big thing done around him, so he wouldn't end up playing for Spain, a kind of, and I think his father definitely wanted him to play for Argentina, and I can understand that in a way. I think, I mean, well, in one way, I think nationalities are all nonsense. We should just be done with them. But I think I can understand that. So it's a very different migratory experience, even though within football you get them all, because football is the biggest mover of, you know, of labor, certainly in South America. Having said all that, Messi is also completely revered and adored here. And although some people say, oh, he never won the World Cup, and some people say, oh, he plays better for Barcelona than from Argentina, again, you know, let's not get too tied down to tabloid headlines. It's a little bit like what you asked me about the 86 Maradona handball. I mean, sure, there is a media narrative that seeks to create this incredible problem. And people are divided, but really there is a lot of amazing respect and pride that Messi's from Argentina. And in fact, someone asked me, would it be different if he'd actually ended up playing for Spain? And I think, no, it wouldn't. We would all say, ah, yes, but he was born in Argentina, which is what we say about, you know, Nobel Prize winners or Hollywood composers that have won Oscars and so on. He's from Argentina, you know, with enormous pride, even though then they win the Oscar for some kind of Hollywood production company or the Nobel Prize for Cambridge University. There's an affinity and a sense of belonging that comes from sharing things that go beyond the passport or even the representation that you seek to endorse. I think Messi will be as respected and as revered as Maradona. In a way, he's better off because really, you know, Maradona was consumed, chewed up, spat out, and ultimately died alone in horrendous circumstances. And he was a very... There was a human somewhere in there, but he just became a thing, a thing that people laid claim to. And I think Messi's doing slightly better in being a little bit more reserved and guarded and having some level of a life of his own that isn't out there for us all to, who knows?
On Maradona, there was, I just did a little bit of reading around whatever books I could pull off the shelf that had Argentina in their index. And I found a line by Jorge Valdano about Maradona to say, "We poor Diego, we kept saying you're a god, but we forgot to tell him the most important thing, you're a man, or, you know, you're a human." To what extent was Maradona's life effectively ruined by the fame?
Well, I don't know if it was ruined because in a way it was. I mean, he got very depressed and unhappy and found it very hard to be okay without it. I think he really needed it. It was part of his addiction and his drug and his pathology. You know, he really got down and some people are saying that during the lockdown last year in the kind of the pandemic 2020, that's what totally did him, completely did him in, because he was so alone and there were no fans and no crowds and no football stuff. So that was very, very noticeably something that had a terrible effect on him or maybe even ended up killing him. It's very difficult to be concise or say one thing about Maradona's fame or celebritydom in general. You know, it does seem to have a very high toll on a lot of things, being super famous. And at times I think he really believed he was the most famous person on the planet. So that has to be difficult to handle. The fame itself I'm less concerned by than the way we consume celebrityism generally as societies. And certainly when I was growing up and now I think there is a kind of reality TV effect. We just watch, we lap it up. The more horror, the more sordid, the more, you know, cocaine ridden and blood and violence and sex scandals, the more we lap it up. But I just think we're in an interactive age. You know, we don't just have to take what the media throws at us and just lap it up. We've got to enter somehow. People should intervene. And I've written about Gascoigne weeping on the pitch, you know, in 1990, and Lineker looking at Robertson going, watch out for him, he's not good. And then I heard years later a documentary where the coach said, well, what could I do? I was on the bench. What could I do? And I think, well, we're not just all on the bench unable to do something. If a guy's clearly needs help and it's literally live to the entire planet, we've got to have some sort of social resource to say, help this guy, help this person, help this kid, or help this woman, if it's an actress, if it's an Amy Winehouse. I mean, I don't know if you saw Capadia's film about Maradona, but I recommend it, and about Amy And I think there are very interesting parallels, you know, that are, or threads that going through. There's a point at which some people are clearly very driven to do their art. They're magnificent, outstanding, out of this world, and that drive needs to be nourished because they are artists.
Mm.
But then they break down, and we can't just say, "Oh well, oh yeah, whatever." You know, he was like that, so he's got to die alone now, exploding in a kind of.
And I always thought, I just to go back to the point you made about Messi perhaps handling this better. Like, I always used to slightly irk me that, you know, Messi was amazing to watch, but I didn't find him to be a very interesting person. I found him to be, you know, pretty boring and dull, and vacuous, maybe too far to go, but definitely that's the side of him that he showed to us. But actually, that is a necessary defense at the in the modern age against celebrity and against, you know, your face being totally eaten by the mask that we put up to them. What's your impression of Messi? Because you've interviewed him. Like, do you think that when he sits down to talk to journalists or when he's sitting in front of a camera, he's holding something back, or is what you see the person he is?
I interviewed him a long time ago, who's very young. And I was quite struck by how I don't know, there was something about him, which I've since come to think he might be a little bit on the spectrum of, you know, some sort of very high functioning but mild Asperger's or something, because he did seem quite literal. And but the thing that most struck me when I went to interview him in Barcelona was after the interview. We were in the car park with a journalist that we traveled together, and there was a big Barcelona shop, and there was some people walking in. It wasn't a match day or anything, so it was pretty quiet. But there were tourists and people milling about going into the shop or going to visit the stadium. And there was a man who clearly worked at the stadium doing something like sweeping or, I don't know, arranging something around some cars that were parked. And a younger man was eating an apple, leaning on the car, chatting to this guy. And as we packed up our stuff and said thank you very much to various people. And I looked again, and it was Messi. That's Messi sitting in a car park eating an apple. And there's loads of people walking around him, and they're not even noticing that it's Messi. Whereas if Maradona arrived in the same city as you, you would feel it. He was there, you know, he literally couldn't walk for fans and people trying to touch him. And that was an incredibly poignant contrast. And I thought, what is it? What is that? Is that a chemistry in the person? Is it about attitude? Is it a decision? So I don't know if Messi's boring or if we have a right to call someone boring because they haven't entertained us particularly. I mean, he might think we're quite boring in the sense that he wouldn't pick up a paper to see what we've eaten for breakfast today. Or, but he's definitely a very unusual person. And I think there is a very defensive thing in his entourage about delving into this spectrum idea. Some psychologists in Brazil wrote a lot about it, and they laid some, you know, lawsuits on him. And that to me is a shame, because I think if he was, you know, if they were less defensive about neurodivergence as an entourage, the brand Messi is as big as brand Maradona, and you know, the innings, what goes on there is possibly as hideous as anything.
What do you mean?
Well, battles for controlling the brand, the you know, it's an empire, the deals, the whole thing with Barcelona. I think it's interesting. The tax issues, clearly it's everything's managed. It's an enormous amount of money managed by all sorts of accountants and lawyers and who knows. So what I mean, I wouldn't want to say, oh, Messi's a lovely guy. He's just a quiet family man, and all he does is play his football and then go fishing in his little shed by the water. I think there is a brand Messi and a business empire around Messi that's as big, if not bigger, than Maradona's. And there's complicated in terms of the image rights and the money it generates and how it's going about generating more money.
Yeah.
Possibly more professional than Maradona's. I don't know. Possibly more organized. But the guy, the talent, as an industry, there are lots of ramifications that go around football, but the center of it all is the talent, like any entertainment industry.
Sorry, this is a very esoteric and possibly stupid question, but I'll ask it anyway, and I have the luxury of editing out if it is deemed to be a bad question. But when you talk about Messi being a brand, his image, like physical image, completely changed around like 2015, 2016. I don't know if you've ever seen that image of him in the Barcelona dressing room with Neymar is there, Dani Alves is there, and they're dressed like they look ridiculous, like in crazy clothes, torn jeans, massive boots, shiny jackets. They look ridiculous. And Messi looks like he just stepped out of his first confirmation. You know, he's wearing this shirt and jumper and black jeans and black shoes. And now he's, you know, now he's all tattooed and he's got a beard and he's got his hair trimmed. And I was wondering, is that a brand thing? Is that a cultivated image thing? Because how he looks now is kind of at odds with how I understand him. I don't know. Do you have an opinion on this, or is this like a ludicrous take?
No, I don't think it's a ludicrous question. I mean, I think there's been Colin Inch has written about it at the time and so on. And was it his wife's influence and Antonella made him do it, or... Yes, possibly. Did his image advisor say you've got to be cool and you've got to have a little, you know, goatee because it's the look of our times? Maybe he wanted to look different. I don't know. But if you take a 15-year period over anyone who put pictures next to each other, I mean, even Maradona changed his look a lot. I mean, and with Maradona, it's not even linear, you know. I mean, I remember seeing them with Madonna at the time, or even Michael Jackson, you know, these little passport size over time images. Maradona would kind of get really fat and then be really fit and be completely scruffy and then be incredibly good looking with yellow hair, locks, beard. And it just in a kind of swirl, you know, like a spiral. There wasn't a progression. With Messi, I see more of a progression. Like you say, for a long time, he looked like a child. He's tiny and he's got a baby face. And then at some point, he kind of looked more like a man.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's the birth of his children or someone said, or maybe he got an endorsement, you know, maybe he gets money for wearing, I don't know, a particular type of T-shirt or necklace. I wouldn't be surprised. But I don't, again, I feel, who cares?
Yeah.
What he looks like. I really do. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
The tattoos are interesting because they're quite in your face and they're big and you think, will he regret them? But then if he regrets them, he'll just have them removed.
He can afford it. The good news, Marcella.
Exactly.
The good news, Marcella, is that our listener questions are a lot better than mine.
I didn't mean to say that's a bad question because I've seen a lot of stuff discussing it. I just find it really hard to say, oh, yes, that tells us something deep and interesting. Football player gets tattoos.
Collie asks, Collie wants to hear Marcella on Marcelo. So a couple of questions on Marcelo Bielsa. How popular and respected is he in Argentina today? And how aware are they of his work at Leeds?
Well, everybody watches Leeds. Everybody. And I think there was something particularly fantastic about Leeds going up in the pandemic. So there was just everybody was at home anyway, and the lockdown here was very strict, and you know, lockdown in England was quite strict at the time. So I had this incredible sense of communion online. I was in England with everyone in Argentina. Lots of people are delighted. There is, again, you know, when he was the manager of Argentina, everything looked very promising until we got to the World Cup, and then it was an early exit. And I wouldn't say Argentinians hold anything against, you know, they tend to enjoy World Cups quite a lot. I remember in 1998, when Ortega was sent off for headbutting a Dutch player. Was it Stan? I can't remember. Anyway. So in 1998, Ortega was sent off for headbutting a Dutch player. The World Cup, Argentina were doing fantastically well. And immediately everyone's going, oh, poor Ortega, you know, what a difficult thing. And I remember going back to England after the World Cup, and Beckham, of course, had been sent off for kicking Simeone in the game against Argentina, and they were literally out for his head. I mean, it was, they sold dolls. You could buy a Beckham effigy doll with pins to pin it. That was an actual thing that you could buy in a shop. And the headlines were awful. They were so violent. And so I always thought, oh gosh, you know, these people are really angry about going out of a World Cup. I don't think Argentinians are that angry. I mean, I think they get sad for a minute because they really love getting whipped up in the frenzy of being in the competition. But then, so Bielsa was forgiven for 2002, ultimately. Although then his personality and his obsessiveness, and I think he doesn't like winning. So I always say, has he lost yet? He gets really close. And then, and I don't say that in a bad way, because I think I have the same problem. I get really close to achieving amazing accomplishments, even personally. And then I just, don't really want to. So people here are aware of that, and some are a bit tired, and they joke about whenever he gets a job, they joke about how long will it last. But he's very, very respected and well known and acknowledged and recognised as a you know, one of us who's gone and done well. And in his city, in Rosario, and his club in Newell's, he is absolutely revered. And just not just him, but his family, his sister, who's a politician for many years there, and his brother, who is currently still in politics at national level, but mostly his sister, was really active in combating corruption and violence in football in Rosario, which is a story on its own. You know, Newell's had a really, really corrupt president for many years, and she was determined kind of involving civic action and proper grassroots activism to clean up the club. So there he is. His is the name of the stadium.
Connor asks, to what extent did the military dictatorship effectively claim the 1978 World Cup? Which is a nice handy question.
So I've just literally been working on a documentary about the 1986 World Cup for an English production company and ultimately for FIFA. And there was a question about the dictatorship for every player, which I'm not sure. But then we passed it to a journalist that we were interviewing. And it was like, oh, blah, blah, dictatorship. We said, they love the dictatorship, don't they, those guys? They really want to talk about it. In 1978, I think it's way, 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 way more justified. Something that I think is really important and that's not often mentioned in with regard to the 1978 World Cup or the dictatorship generally in Argentina is that throughout most of last century, most of South America was in and out of military dictatorships. Democratic governments coexisted with military coups. Very complex reasons why most of South America was in and out of military coups. And you know, 1970 Brazil, 1966 Argentina had a military coup. Then we had a democratic government for a bit, and then there was another coup in the 70s. So the relationship of the military and the World Cup is also complex and interesting in the sense that the World Cup had been adjudicated to Argentina before the coup. And at one point they thought of cancelling it, the military, because it sounded a bit like fun and, you know, laugh and games. And then they thought, no, let's bank on it. And at one point the resistance, the guerrillas and the left also wanted to boycott it and cancel it because it seemed like handing the military something they could rejoice on a plate. And then they also decided not to because it was a good way of getting Argentina in the eyes of the world, and there was, you know, an opportunity to, I don't know, it, but ultimately because they like football. I mean, there's I interviewed a woman whose appalling story was that she was detained in one of these clandestine detention centres with tortures and so on during the World Cup. And she was forced to watch the games as part of the rehabilitation programme. And then when Argentina won, she was taken with a group of detainees by the military to celebrate in the streets, driven around. And she kind of, it's an incredibly strong image, but she says she asked for permission to step out of the open roof, the little Persian, and saw that sea of people thinking, if I start screaming now, help me, I'm a disappeared, would anyone hear me? Am I? Which of course they wouldn't, but that's always made me think, actually, no one would ever hear you if you shout, they've pinched my wallet in a frenzied football crowd. You know, you can't, got no chance of any kind of real help unless, well, you know, it's, yeah, a pretty, it's a pretty loud noise. But so Dalleo's story, which is incredible, and it's the story of a lot of people. I mean, yesterday someone rang me saying there was some sort of CNN podcast in the States. They're looking for somebody who didn't rejoice and celebrate the World Cup because they had a relative or a friend that was disappeared and detained. And through knowing what was going on, they didn't enjoy the football. And I'm like, good luck finding that person, because ultimately the detainees were enjoying the football and they had written at great length about how weird this was for them. But you would have a perverse scenario where the torturer and the tortured would discuss the goals between, you know, sessions or, yeah, discuss the match. And that, I think, is both absolutely hideous, but also speaks of the extraordinary thing that is football. So we can't just ignore it or judge it or say that's wrong or that should, you know, football provokes a true emotional reaction in people, and that's real, and that's so real that we have to respect it and use it for the good. I can see that your mouth is dropped open.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary story. Like, so, like, you all, it, from, in our media anyway, we hear a lot more about the 86 World Cup than we do about the 78 World Cup. But it sounds like, you know, it's, I thought that the 78 World Cup might be tainted by its association with that dictatorship and the horrors of that time, but perhaps it's not.
Well, I think it kind of is in many ways tainted because there was then a lot of talk about it being fixed, and there was a lot of, kind of moralizing pressure on the player. You know, there was people say to the players ended up taking the brunt for this. You know, why did you not refuse to play? And it's like, well, because I'm an athlete, and what else could I do? You know, and I've witnessed the conversation over and over. And have the Olympics in China, and you go to the Olympians. Why are you going to go to China? It's a terrible country with a terrible human rights record. It's South Africa in the 80s, you know, there were boycotts, and arguably they worked. It's not an easy answer. I think the 78 World Cup was tainted for the allegations of buying the game, especially the one against Peru, or not buying, but, you know, somehow. I don't know. The players all deny it. I believe the players. I think it's a difficult thing to do. I mean, Ardiles said to me once, I don't believe it happened, not because I don't consider the military capable of doing it, but I just don't see how. But at the same time, for those of us who lived here and lived through it, it really was a happy occasion. Mm. And then we need the there is a guilt about celebrating. I mean, I wrote a thing about when my father died. I wrote a piece about him and football and my relationship with him and so on, remembering that at the World Cup final, he took us, I was with some friends at his house, and he drove us back into town, and we got stuck. We couldn't move any further after about an hour and a half. It with the papers and the ticker tape and the singing. And it was the same stretch of road where this woman, Graciela de Leon, was taken to a restaurant. Yeah. When I met her, I was an adult, and she told me, I said, oh my God, because she literally described where it was and the restaurant they went to, and that, you know, she scribbled something with her lipstick on the mirror in the restaurant saying, this will be my single act of resistance. Just said, help. You know, I am... We are disappeared, and then just went back to the table. And I, as an 11-year-old, had no idea she was there. So one would like to think, of course, if you don't leave, you just bumped into me at that problem of great, you know, at that time of great troubles, I would have solved your problem, or my dad would have said something to the police or something. But in fact, there is a powerlessness to what we can do, which is really difficult to stomach. And so it would be really easy to say, how dare I celebrate that World Cup, now knowing what was going on the same stretch of road. I can't do that, because I do think, for better or for worse, there was a truce. There was peace for a month. There were no bombs and no shootings and I think no disappearance, but jury's still out. And so if we just focus on the football, which we can do by watching the games again, it was really quite good. I mean, it was it was great. And so for me personally, we owe those players two huge debts of gratitude. One for winning the World Cup, which is just such a fun thing to happen. And two, for being a part of this lull in the horror. You know, it was a really shitty time to live here. It was really awful. And in the middle of it, there was a month of utter fun and joy. And I think ultimately that's a good thing. I mean, if I was now to have to vote or organise or say, should we have a World Cup in certain circumstances, I probably would say no. I would kind of say no anyway about World Cups, because they're expensive and difficult. But the reason why the 78 World Cup became tainted after the event is partly because of this sort of moralising, how dare you be happy when something bad is going on, which is one of the things that humans like to do and say to each other. And also because somehow the 86 World Cup, which should also be quite tainted for the handball, if you like, feels open and transparent. It's like if the 78 World Cup was somehow rigged, it was done in backroom deals by powerful men in secret, conniving in an exploitative way with the players, not the talent, not participant, not knowing. And that's kind of disgusting. Whereas if the 86 World Cup was somehow not fairly gotten, it was done literally by him in full view of the entire world, just openly saying, this is how I play, and if you don't like it, stuff it. But
there's a kind of honesty. It's my game.
Yes, exactly. Transparency.
That's all fascinating stuff. We are a little bit tight for time, I know, Marcella, so we will...
I'm really sorry. I go on and on.
No, that is fantastic. That's so interesting. We'll do our two final questions, but before that, one last listener question from Paddy, who's asking for book recommendations on the best book to understand modern Argentina, if we can throw that at you, and if you've got anything.
Modern Argentina, gosh.
Mm. Or as modern as has been chronicled.
I would very much recommend, this in Spanish or in English. If we're in English, I'm stuck.
Okay. Well, he didn't specify. I would have guessed English, but...
If he speaks Spanish, I would recommend Dante Panseri, Leadership, Decency, and Wine. And this guy, Dante Panseri, was a sports writer of absolute genius, writing with his pen. In fact, when you asked me for books that have influenced me, I should have immediately said his, but I seem to have gotten out of my time for that. So Dante Panseri, and he in fact went to England in 1966 to cover that World Cup, and he said Argentina were dismal and shameful, and that the whole setup with the FA was appalling. He was so critical, and he was such a kind of obsessive and meticulous tactician as well. And I remember Carlos Bilardo, who's Argentina's manager in 86, saying to me once, we had massive rows with Panseri, but we really liked each other and respected each other. So that would be a book to understand sports writing in Argentina and the culture of sports, of sports thinking. Modern Argentina, I don't know that there is a great book. It needs to be written. I would recommend some of the young novelists. Mariana Enriquez is being published in the UK now. I don't know if she would give you a sense of modern Argentina, but she would give you a sense of the intellectual level. She's a young novelist doing very well now. I would recommend Borges always. He won't make you understand Argentina at all. He'll make you understand how weird it is that there is a world in which Borges can be an Argentinian and so can Maradona.
Yeah.
Yes, I would read Borges a lot, all the time, in fact. I would make it compulsory at schools.
Our two final questions, Marcella. We throw these at everybody. Where is the most interesting place that work has brought you?
Oh, goodness. wow. Well, lots of very interesting places. I guess the ones I love the most are small towns in Argentina. But just last week, we went to Bursaco, which is just a small place outside Buenos Aires, and the week before to Saladillo. And they're kind of, Saladillo particularly, actually, we're interviewing players from the 1986 World Cup, where they live now. And I mean, in fact, we could only do these two where they live now because of COVID and so on. A lot of people don't want to open their homes. But the director said, we've got to make another film about these towns, you know, just where the world champions and the towns they come from. Because that it's not that it was so interesting, like more interesting than, I mean, I did a nice piece in 2014 from a favela with a group of kids from an Argentinian slum that have a great cooperative project going called The Deep Throat, La Garganta, which is a fab magazine, the best interviews of footballers of theirs. And they got a grant to go and cover the World Cup for their slum magazine from a slum. And that was incredible. That was an incredible day because it was like really hanging out with them and seeing how they lived and did all the, and they did proper World Cup coverage. You know, they loved the football, but they also did lots of stuff on child prostitution and price indexing and so on. So it was a really great thing to see. And then I suppose, you know, the World Cup in France, that took me all over France for a month because I did the whole thing. That was lovely and fun, but I don't know if I would say it's the most interesting place or somewhere that I might not have gone to anyway. But I love it when someone says, I'm from wherever. Someone said yesterday, Porto Alegre, or it could be Frankfurt or something. I go, oh, I've been there. But and they say, well, do you like it? Or Dublin. I've only been to a football game and then back. Nothing else. Nothing else. I don't know anything.
Yeah.
Anything else about that city. But what a lovely stadium, Dublin Stadium.
Which one? Is this the new one or the old Lansdowne?
No, certainly not new. Yeah.
The old one.
Definitely not new. You've done a very good replica.
And then finally, the most interesting person that you've met through work.
Well, I'd have to say Maradona because I think interesting but I've made some friends in football, not loads, but I think I've met some very lovely people. Valdano, I would rank very high. Some really interesting women throughout that, you know, work in press rooms and in kit rooms and stadiums. And in fact, I was thinking I wanted to do something about that, all the women that actually work in football that no one acknowledges or recognises. One died last year here, and I thought, gosh, that she was so key for me being able to do this job in the early 90s and the mid 90s. I suppose I have to say Di Stefano, Maradona and Messi, just because they are the symbols of something that makes the game so huge. And as a compatriot, I'm then, you know, forever indebted that they've opened so many doors for me.
Marcella, thank you so much. That was a fascinating conversation. So thanks, Emil. Thanks so much to Marcella. Thanks to you for your support of The 42 and for listening to Behind the Lines. It is greatly appreciated. Reminder, you can get in touch with us, by the way. You can email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm at gcooney93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. We're back next week with our live event with Roy Thompson. So I will no doubt be chatting to some of you directly then. Until then, take it easy.